Welcome to Policy Chats, the official podcast of the School of Public Policy at the University of California, Riverside. I'm your host, Kevin Karami. Join me and my classmates as we learn about potential policy solutions for today's biggest societal challenges. Joining us today is California Secretary of State, Dr. Shirley Weber. School of Public Policy alum Maddie Bunting and I chatted with her about her career in public service.
Shirley Weber was nominated to serve as California Secretary of State by Governor Gavin Newsom on December 22, 2020, and sworn into office on January 29, 2021. She is California's first African-American Secretary of State and only the fifth African-American to serve as a state constitutional officer in California's 170-year-long history. Dr. Weber, it is an honor to have you here with us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I always love talking to students. I kind of miss you guys. I'm kind of in withdrawal after 40 years of teaching, but it's always good to be with students.
Well, that's great to hear. I know everyone's excited to start getting to know you. So I'm going to start with a very general question. How did you get involved in public service and politics?
You know, I saw that question and I was thinking to myself, how far back do you go? You know, I don't remember a moment in time when I really became involved in it. I think a part of my family's life has always been a life of service, whether it's in our church or our community, always trying to make a difference, making sure that we helped our neighbors and our friends and those who had lost loved ones. My mother was always the person on the block taking food to their homes, making sure they were secure, volunteering me to write all the obituaries in the neighborhood because I had good writing skills. So I learned a lot about the people in the community where I lived, but always, you know, believing that we had to do what we could to make the world a little bit better and make life a little easier for people. So I've always had this as a part of my existence and always sought ways in at the church where I was attending as a young person, how we could make a difference as young people, not waiting for us to become adults, but seeing the problems that we face. And so at about 15, I think, or 16, one, because I went to a very large church, we decided we were going to host a Thanksgiving dinner for those who didn't have food and around the church in the neighborhood. And we, and the church was kind of shocked, but we had it well organized and we basically asked people to donate the food. So some members donated their turkey dinner and this and that. And so as young people, we put on the very first giveaway, food giveaway at that church way back in the early 60s. And so, you know, so I've always had that as a part of my existence. My engagement with politics was always that I was going to help somebody run for office. I was definitely going to vote. I was definitely going to pay attention and help educate people about voting, but never saw myself as a politician, other than maybe student government, you know, where you kind of participate and volunteer things. But it was not on my agenda that someday I would run for political office. No, never, ever. I was just going to make sure that I did the best because I love teaching and I love being in schools and I love watching young people learn and grow and see their eyes open wide when they really discover something exciting. So I never saw myself as a politician. And to this day, I still argue that I'm not a politician because I don't always act like a politician. I have to say that I don't always do the same things as other politicians do. And so I'm a little bit different than that. But obviously, you know, if you want to make things happen, you learn very quickly that sometimes you have to step forward and do that because that's probably the fastest way to make change.
It's so inspiring to hear you talk about how active you have been forever, for it's all you really know. And I think that's such a wonderful trait that your family seems to have instilled in you. I'm just curious, do you have any specific experience or moment that sparked your interest in getting involved in public service and politics? It seems like you talked about public service, but any specific, did you just think politics and government was the place where you could do the most work?
Well, you know what? I've always been drafted. I have to be very honest about that. I have never volunteered to run for anything. I've always been drafted. And it's not that I was afraid of politics. I just felt that I was so busy. I was always doing something else that seemed to be more exciting. You know, I probably got some of a political profile, I think, in terms of politics, because the area in which I went to at the university in terms of Black studies immediately throws you into a political arena. You know, you go there with an academic mission and you discover that there's an awful lot of politics that has to be played, that you have to figure out the academic senate and you have to figure out how communities can come and move an institution like a university that is, that claims that it's liberal and it's open and what have you, but it is more entrenched in tradition and itself than any institution I'd ever been in. And so I had to learn that. I mean, I was 23 years old, university professor, trying to start Black studies because we've been brought in to do that. And I had to learn the politics of the campus. I had to learn the politics of the Black community because it was the community that was really pushing the agenda for ethnic studies and the women's organizations and the others that were outside. And so I became the kind of the voice and the face of ethnic studies and all the ethnic studies groups that were there at a very young age. And so I then had to begin to push the university, push the academic senate, get on every freaking committee they had in order to make a difference. And so I had to learn the politics of the university, who's in power, how to deal with folks who have egos and those that don't have little egos, and how to basically make them move in our direction. But equally important, had to deal with the Black community and the Chicano communities that were there, because they were the ones really with the power. You know, we could have been just completely ignored and wiped out because students have a tendency to change every 3 to 4 years. They're graduating, they're moving on, they're doing their thing. And so when you've got something that you want to establish that's permanent, like an ethnic studies department, you have to have a permanent support base. You have to have folks who are going to be there. And that turns out to be the people who live in those neighborhoods, who live in those Black communities, who are a part of those organizations that pushed hard to get ethnic studies. They're going to be there longer than the students. The students each time will come and add energy to it and push it, but it's really that force that's outside or the faculty force that's within. And so I had to learn the Black community. I was involved in it when I was in Los Angeles, but when I went to San Diego, I had to really entrench myself in that community so that they would have confidence in me. They would see me as a leader, that they would come to campus to help us out, that we would had to go to meetings to explain to them the dynamics that were occurring and where the political base was and the political power, because most of those communities had very little contact with universities and with power bases and institutions, because they seem so aloof and so far off, and they're stenched in all these rules of senates and tenure and non-tenure and all these kinds of things. So at a very early age, I got thrown in the fire. You know, I got thrown in the fire, and as a result of that, I kind of met people along the way who then, when I had children, I got even more in the fire because they were in schools, and I had to then deal with the school board and challenge some of the policies that I thought were inadequate. Being an activist and studying Black movements, the first thing I knew that if I wanted my schools to be better, my children had to be in those schools, that I could not put them in private school because then that allows me to only participate as an observer. You know, when my kid was enrolled in that school in the Black community, I was in the school. You know, I was the school. I was the force. And so that if the school's going to get better, it's because I had people there that were going to work and do it. And so I recruited other Black parents to come to the school where my kids were, parents who were teachers and who were others, and some former students of mine, because we wanted to make a difference at Encanto Elementary School. And we did. And so as a result, we got very involved with the policies at the school board, some policies that were very detrimental to Black and brown communities or poor communities. And we got involved. And I discovered that, you know, because I had all this PhD and some time and some knowledge, that the community people loved it, because then I could write the documents for them. I could go before the board and articulately express better than the board members themselves the policies that they were trying to push on us. And so people began to activate themselves and become involved. And that was great because it was really the community pushing forward with what it wanted. And interestingly enough, that's how people decided you got to run for school board. And I was like, oh, no, you know, wrong decision. Let's go a different direction. Let's change this drama. But that's how I actually got into the school thing, the K-12 school, when I was at the university. I got in there because my kids were there, because the issues were there. They were integrating schools. They were making policies that were not beneficial to the kids at that school. And my kids were in that school. So it was not like I could talk about it in some distant way. This was direct. And this was Akilah and Akil in Canto Elementary School, my kids, my friends' kids, and we could make a difference. And we learned that very quickly as a result of the things that we introduced for the campus to do. So it was truly baptism by fire without intentions at all, but we got involved in it. And that kind of pushed folks toward me, I should say, in terms of looking for me for leadership.
The UC Riverside School of Public Policy is excited to announce the launch in fall 2022 of its new combined BA and Master of Public Policy program. As the only such program offered exclusively within a public policy school in the entire UC system, the UCR BA MPP will allow public policy students to complete both their public policy major and graduate studies in 5 years. Learn more at spp.ucr.edu/BA-MPP for more information. You can also find the link in our show notes.
That's really great to hear, Dr. Weber. I think it's really interesting that you mentioned that you, in a lot of ways, were kind of thrust into your positions, into your roles, and it wasn't so much so that you volunteered, but that, you know, other people kind of around you helped push you into those positions of influence and power, and, you know, in the various positions that you served in. And so I think that's a really, really interesting note, because I haven't, you know, in my experience, I haven't really met anyone who's described it like that. Usually it's a personal desire to want to get involved or run for office or whatnot. But the fact that there was this kind of almost community support is really, really interesting to hear. On that note,
I just want to say, like, that's such a huge compliment that people for your entire career are seeking you out. I just think, for me, especially a public policy student and someone interested in government and politics, like, that is just the highest form of compliment of, you know, you're meeting the task, but everyone's rallying around you and, you know, like, guiding you in this path and wanting you and recognizing all your strengths and everything that
That's so true. But also because I didn't see politics as the only way I could make a difference. Mm-hmm. You see, I believe very strongly that it didn't matter where I was going to be, I was going to help. I was going to do something. I was going to make a difference. If it's working in a social organization in the community, which I worked in a lot of them, and I didn't have to be the leader. I never felt I had to thrust myself to be the leader. I believe very strongly that the best people in organizations are great followers. I mean, folks who can follow through on things, who can work with the leader that's there. And so I had no problems in following folks. I had no problems in being a great leader, a great member of an organization. And so it wasn't the only way to make a difference. And I think sometimes when I meet people and they believe that the only thing they can do is run for office, the only thing way they can make a difference is to become an elected official. I think that is so, I don't know. It's not that I want to kill people's desire to run for office, because I think people who want to run should run. But it somehow or another limits your view of the world, because only one person's going to win. So if you don't win, what do? You sit around and wait to win? No, you keep working in the world where you live. You make a difference where you are. It doesn't matter whether you're the assembly member or you're on the staff or the volunteer for the assembly member. You have a task, an opportunity to make a difference. And that's why my kids always say, I'll never stop working. And that's probably true, because I'll always make a difference. You know, they say, what are you going to do when you're no longer in office? I said, I'm going to do what I'm doing now. I'm going to help kids. I'm going to advocate for stuff. I'm going to find a way to do something. I'm going to create an international program that I've done before to help young people travel and see the world. I'm going to deal with the issues of race and try to change that. I mean, there's just so much to do that, yeah, elected officials can do some of that, and some will. But there's also so much that you can do just as a citizen, just as a person in your community, just as a student at your school. You know, I had so many students who did so many amazing things when they were students. Amazing things. Some of them have moved on, and some of them have taken those things they've done and turned them into life work, you know? So it doesn't necessarily mean we all have to be elected officials. It's good when we get elected officials who will respond to the needs and help us. But elected officials need strong community leaders and people in the community to add life to the policies that we make. I mean, you know, so I didn't see it as something that I had to do to make a difference. And sometimes it makes it easier. Sometimes it complicates matters. But I was just a servant. And every time I looked around, somebody was calling me because they knew I was strong. I was determined. I wouldn't sell them out. Nobody could buy me. You know, I wasn't looking for a job in the community, so I wasn't pimping the poor. I mean, I was just trying to make the world better. And it was always a compliment when people would come to me and I said, you know what? I think, you know, we can find somebody else. And they would always say, no, we found somebody. And sometimes I'd argue with them and make them find somebody else. But it's nice that people think that you can do things. And it is a compliment. It is a compliment that people see you even when you're not trying to be seen. You're just doing what you got to do.
I think that's such a powerful message that you don't have to be an elected official in, you know, top level of government to actually make a difference, to actually give back to the community. And, you know, you see a lot where people feel that they need that position, they need that power, they need that, you know, those connections, that influence or whatnot, to actually serve their communities, to actually make a difference, a positive difference. But I think it's so amazing that, you know, given your history and all the amazing work you've done, that even you would admit that you don't have to do, you know, you don't have to go down that path to make a difference. I think that, you know, is such a powerful message. On that note, I do want to ask, you know, I know we talked about you don't have to be an elected in office, but you did serve as an assembly member in California. And you know, on campus, we have a lot of students who are interested in that, who are interested in getting involved in that capacity. I wanted to ask, what was your experience like, you know, running for office, running a campaign, and then actually being an assembly member? What was that experience like?
You know, it was, you know, when you run for office, you know, I tell people all the time, if you want to run, you have to really commit yourself. And that's something that you want to do, because it is a very lonely experience. And most people don't talk about it that way, but it is a lonely experience. That once you decide to run, there'll be people who will come and go. And a few will stay, but in the end, it is you. You are the one who has to do all the stuff that's necessary. You have to make all the appearances. You have to beg for money. You have to raise the money that's there. You have to take all the stress, because it's extremely stressful. I mean, you know, people call you with all kinds of things late at night, early in the morning. I saw your opponent on television. Why weren't you there? You know, da, da, da. Oh, my God. You know what? I'm telling you, it can drive you insane. I mean, people will, you know, because they want you to win and they're nervous about it and they don't have the big picture of everything that's taking place. And so it is a very stressful kind of experience. And then when you run for an area and when you run and you've never had, you've not yourself had someone as a role model to work with you, it becomes really difficult. I was fortunate that Tony Atkins had helped me, wanted me to run, talked me into running and said, I'd help you. And that was great because she did. But I didn't have an African-American role model. I didn't have someone who could understand the issues of not only gender, but also issues of race. I didn't have when you're running in a city like San Diego, where there's never been an African-American who has actually won an assembly seat in the history of California. And you're running in this office. And so you're trying to manage not only one community, but several different communities, meet those needs that are there. You hope you're doing the right thing. You've got great campaign people. And I had, when I ran for the assembly, I had a great person who understood my story. And that was important, because then my story became the things that people remembered, who I was, where I came from, how I had come from projects to from Arkansas and projects onto universities and began to interact in that circle. Because when you're in a city like San Diego in this situation, I go to events, and this was even before I ran, I was the only African-American in the room. I was the only African-American female sometimes. Every now and then there'd be a male. But most of the time in the high-level political world that I operated in at that time, I was the only African-American in the room. You know, so you got a tremendous amount of pressure because everybody knows who you are because you're the only African-American in the room and everybody watches and everybody's looking for what you're going to do and the signs and symbols. And so it became very, very, it can be very stressful. You know, at that point, it can be very stressful, but I had great staff. I had people who believed in me. I had some older women on my block who volunteered, didn't have a lot of money, but they said they were going to open my campaign office every day from 9 to 5, 7 days a week. And they did without any pay. And that was their contribution to the campaign. And they had all retired. So they were in their 70s and they were retired, but they kept my campaign office open and professional. And that was their contribution to the campaign. And I'll never forget those two women. I don't care what table I buy at some banquet or whatever. They're the first ones at the table, you know, because they gave such a tremendous sacrifice to the campaign. And it was that kind of, you sometimes run across that kind of commitment that is permanent because other people go and come. They want to see if you're going to win because then they can get a job, you know, working for you or whatever it may be. But I had a couple of really, really amazing individuals who focused on that, who focused to work on my campaign and just were awesome in terms of what they provided. And I had a great campaign person. But I also, you know, in running, the good thing with me is I had had 40 years of serving this community as a professor, as a school board member, as a member of the NAACP, the Urban League, the you know, Jackie Robinson Y, the United Way. I had had a long history of service so that they knew me. And that made it easier, even though I was running in a campaign of 6 or 7 other people. I had the longest history of knowledge. So when people saw my name, when students saw my name who had now lived in San Diego, when other faculty saw my name, when people in communities, they recognized the name. And that was important. And I tell people, your name is extremely important. And so it was challenging to now look at folks and have to raise money. That's the hardest thing for me is to raise money and, you know, beg people. I'm good at begging for other people. I'm not good at begging for myself. And I had to be trained to believe that I was worthy of folks giving to me because of because I'm so used to getting it for someone else and not for me. But it was a difficult, it wasn't a hard campaign. It was just that it was a transition in my life where I had planned on doing something totally different. And all of a sudden I had to transition now and become a candidate, answering to people, making sure that I could respond to folks and then dealing with the naysayers. I mean, I had people tell me I was too old to run. A woman told me that I was just too old to run. I never had a woman who was about my age, who was against age. And she said, you're not going to be able to do very much. And she went on. And so it was funny because about 5 or 6 years later, I saw and she goes, oh my God, you've done more than all the young people in the assembly, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I said, well, sometimes age and experience help, because you don't have as much anxiety about life as young folks do when they're trying to balance all these things in their future. But it was very stressful, but it and I had to learn a lot because in the past, you know, I kind of ran a campaign or whatever and won, but to have a campaign that was in San Diego and in Sacramento, I had people in Sacramento who didn't believe in me because they said they didn't know me. And I said, well, it's not important that you know me. It's only important that San Diego knows me because those are the folks who vote for me. And so they were all shocked when I won. It's such a large number because in the primary, because they just figured, we don't know this woman. She's not a mayor. She's not a city council member. She's not working here in Sacramento. She's not a part of our party, our group in terms of activities. And so as a result, they were just like, we don't know her. And Tony Atkins was saying, but you will. You know, it's one of those kind of things she kept saying, but you will. And when you meet her, you will know what you've missed out all your life. And so it was really kind of funny, but it was a difficult campaign to constantly try to sell yourself after so many years of working in communities and things of that nature. But I took it as a really unique opportunity once I discovered that no African-American had ever won the seat before. And I realized that if nothing else, I had to win so they could realize that they could, you know, that they could actually break this wall down that had been up. And many people had run before, but they had never won. And I thought, okay, I can't lose. You know, I can't lose because if I lose, and maybe another 15, 20 years for anybody to try to run again, believing that this is something just can happen in San Diego, because San Diego doesn't have a large Black population. But it does have an opportunity for people to meet an awful lot of people. And there are a lot of people here who will evaluate you based on who you are and what you've done, much more than the color of your skin. And so that was one of the things I was pleased about. I said, we're going to break this barrier down. And then I committed myself as saying, I may be the first, but I won't be the last. And began to work with women to help them run for office in San Diego. And we've got now a number of Black women who are running for office, who are holding positions. And almost every election, there's a couple of Black women on the ballot somewhere running for various positions. And, you know, and we work with them to try to help them understand that this is possible, that you don't have to be in a community that's 50% African-American to run for office, that you can run because you're a good person. And so it was an interesting campaign. And, you know, after that, you know, people kind of knew who I was, and it wasn't, you know, every election was a little bit easier than the last, but surely it challenges you. And like I say, it's a lonely experience, because when you get these crazy calls or you see these polls or you have people calling you, you know, you have to, you know, still believe in yourself when nobody else does.
Social injustice, health disparities, climate change. Are you interested in solving pressing challenges like these currently facing our region and the world? Then consider joining the next cohort of future policy leaders like me by applying for the UCR Master of Public Policy program. Learn more at mpp.ucr.edu. You can also find the link in our show notes.
Absolutely. And representation is so important. You've had such a unique experience that I'm so glad that we have you on this podcast to share your thoughts and your everything that you've gone through to get where you are today. And I mean, it's just really so impressive. And I'm so glad to have this opportunity to speak with you. I'm curious, moving on, you know, in a different capacity at the state level, what has your experience been as California's Secretary of State?
A lot of folks don't know what a Secretary of State is. They, you know, especially young people, they think I take minutes at meetings. I said, no, I don't do that. But, you know, but then they know something about Secretaries of State and they think it's an international experience. And we do some international things. I mean, we do some international verifications of deaths and death birth certificates and all those kinds of things. But it's so we spend a little bit of time explaining to people what the Secretary of State does and the important role that it is. And then people become impressed when they discover that of the constitutional officers, there are 8 of them. Secretary of State's number 3, you know, it's the governor, the lieutenant governor, then it's the Secretary of State. In terms of succession, if something were to happen to people, you'd become governor eventually at some point. So so that's that in itself kind of emphasizes the relationship between what we do and what others do as well. It's been an interesting experience in coming into, because I'm coming out of a situation where one, you know, I'm chair of a department. And so you have that kind of academic world. And so then I transitioned to being in a legislature. And the legislature is a little different because it has very specific goals in terms of writing legislation and doing those kinds of things, but also a constituency that is only, you know, 500,000 people. So you have a smaller world to deal with. When you're Secretary of State, you deal with the whole state. That's number one. You got the whole state. You've got, so which means your constituency is 40 million people. You've got tremendous responsibilities in terms of all these different layers. There's 7 different departments in the Secretary of State's office. There are over 600 employees in the Secretary of State's office. So you have a really almost like a little country that you're running yourself, because you got personnel departments, you've got an IT department, you've got folks who work on policies and legislation. We've got a whole election unit. We've got all the businesses and nonprofits and this and this and that. So it's a huge operation. And but when you break it down in some way, it's just like the assembly. It's people, you know, it's people trying to do a good job. And in the past, and one of the things that I'm doing now with this organization is helping them to understand that it's not just Shirley Weber, the Secretary of State. It's all of us, all 6 of us serving the people of California. And I've always operated as it's a, as this is a family, you know, that when you have issues and concerns, we all work on it. That when you rise, all of us rise. When anything fails, we all fail. And so therefore we have to all put our energy into it. And so we're slowly structuring the organization so that it's not all these silos, but really a family. And I had a guy the other day I was working with, and he was in one of our departments, and they were sharing me all the new things that they're doing. And then he began to cry and said, this is the first time I've really had anybody in this office to care about us, you know? And I said, well, you know, this is a family. This is my family Monday through Thursday. You know, you folks are the ones that I'm working with. We're basically going to be successful together, or we're going to fall on our face together. And we're determined to be successful. So it's been a unique experience for me to work with a state agency, because oftentimes, you know, people who run those state agencies come and go, and they only serve a certain period of time. And I've spent a lot of time knowing that when I've worked with in an agency, whether it's a university or whatever, it's that the people who work there, if they feel loyal to you, they will give you everything they have. They will make sure it happens. They will make sure that it takes place. You know, they will be concerned about your image. You know, I've got people on my staff at the state level who've been with me since I was an assembly member, when I first went into office. Some of them volunteered and worked on my campaign, and they helped me every step of the way, so that when I decided to go and when I was offered Secretary of State, they had to think about it, because some of them were thinking of retiring, and they decided, and others said, you can't leave her over there by herself. You got to go with her. And that's what they did. They came over and they've been a part of the team. They've been helping them understand the culture that I bring to the Secretary of State's office. And because I treat them like family. They're like family. If they're in San Diego, they're visiting me. They're family. I'm helping them structure their lives and their children and their families, because once I care about you and you care about me, then we're never going to fail. We're always going to grow. We're always going to develop. And so I've spent some time working with everyone in our department to make sure that we work together, that I get to know them. I do the same thing with all of 58 counties. I've called every county registrar voter to talk to them, to get to know them personally, to know their families, to help them, to protect them in these times of difficulty. Because once you do that, they become loyal to you. And they work with you, and they have the same kind of value and commitment about what we should need to do for California that you do. And you're just not out there by yourself and failing on your own. They're going to make you successful. I found this to be true in the assembly. I knew something about everybody's family in the assembly, not to be nosy, but to be helpful. You know, that when I had students, they may be Republicans, and they would come and say, I want my son to talk to you because he's trying to go to college and he can't make a decision. I said, okay, because they all knew. I knew a little bit about universities, and I would have them call me. And we talk about what they want to do and where they are and what they're going to be and those kinds of things. The same is true with their wives. Some of them are going back to school and want to know what to do. And so you end up getting to know them because they are people, and the policies you write are about people. Elections are about people, and businesses are about people. And so I want them to understand that I care as much about them as I do the job that we're doing. And together, we'll obviously do a better job. So it was interesting to me because it was quite a change, because I've never had 600 people responding to me at once. And so trying to develop an organization that is effective and that runs effectively for California with 600 people is quite a change, quite an operation. But it's been a good change for them, and it's been a good change for me to test my skills and my passion and my drive and my ability to lead a large organization. And it takes the same skills to run a little one as it does a big one, if you pay attention carefully.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Weber. I think it was so interesting to hear your thoughts on your current position, how it relates, the similarities and differences between that and your experience as an assembly member. And then also how one thing that I love, this theme that you keep talking about, this camaraderie, this teamwork, this community, that, you know, yes, you're the Secretary of State, but there's a team behind you, and the value that you put into your staff, it's just so amazing to see, because I feel like a lot of people, you know, a lot of members of the public might perceive it as might not see that, and they don't see that. But it's great to hear that you value the people that have helped you out throughout your career, and it's just so amazing to hear. in that same vein, to kind of wrap things up, I wanted to ask, you know, we talked a lot about public service. You've devoted your entire life to public service. What about students like us or other community members? What advice do you have for people who maybe aren't as involved right now, but want to get involved in helping their communities and in helping their schools or any other organizations? What kind of advice would you give to students and other members of the community who are interested in that kind of public service that you've been describing?
You know, one of the things I always say is that never wait for the big moment. Do it now. You know, when I think about all the things I've been involved in, I've never really probably been involved in anything that's really, really big, you know, where you get a lot of credit from and you become famous for being on so-and-so's team or whatever, you know, I don't know. Because people wait for that. And sometimes you waste a lot of valuable time and you miss some wonderful lessons because you missed the opportunity to do the small things. And it's those small things that create the big things. There's so much to do, I tell young people. Just think about what you want to do and start putting it together. You know, my friends always complain that I'm forever dragging them into my stuff. And they're my age. And so but they can think about when I wanted to decide that I was going to do a special program to take kids to Africa. Yeah, I didn't have any money. You know, I just had some folks thinking about it and working on it. And we started it. And that led to my study abroad program at San Diego State. And then it led to my girlfriend, me demanding that she bring the high school students from Crawford on with us to South Africa. These are kids who've never been on a plane, never been out of San Diego. All the work that we did in finding agencies to work with and that kind of stuff. You know, I didn't wait for, you know, a program to do water for Africa. Not that that's a bad program, but there was just things that we could do on that campus to make a difference. And we did it. There are communities that you can think about that you can go into. There are kids who need to be tutored, that need help. You know, find your passion. What do you really want to do? What do you really love? You know, in a small way, and then do it. Begin to do it, and you will be surprised that it will lead you into other areas that you had never dreamt of going before. If it's working on a campaign, it's volunteering. I had so many students who came to just volunteer in my office, and one of them eventually came to Sacramento with me and as a student and did an internship, and her energy about a few things that were small initially grew into such an enormous program. You know, she taught me about EBT and food stamps, and she taught me and students needing it. So when you look at all the legislation I did about homeless students and food banks on every campus, when I go on campuses now, people say, here's a food bank as a result of AB blah, 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 because we had to remove some barriers to let food banks bring food onto campus. Things that were just crazy policies that didn't make sense. All of those things emanated from one girl who came to volunteer in my office. Who came to volunteer on my campaign, who then decided she wanted to go take a semester and volunteer at Sacramento State, at Sac State, and work in my office, and began to educate me and my staff about the life of a student. And as a result, all the students started coming with issues about fees being raised and this taking place and that taking place. And much of that legislation revolved around this one girl who told us about food stamps and a problem she had in getting food on campus. So when I look at that and people say, oh, you did all this work on students and you did all this stuff to help college students. And it really was this one girl, this one person, I saw her not long ago, who basically came and did and helped us begin the process. And so never underestimate your ideas, the little things that are there that an elected official won't take you in, won't help you do some things, or some agency who needs some people just to volunteer to come pass out food at a food bank or something. Never underestimate the power of the little things you do. I sat with a student recently when I was in the assembly. I sat with, she came to visit me in the office, in my office, and I kept looking at her face because she looked familiar. And she was a student who decided to go to South Africa with me. Her mother gave her the money. She decided to go. And she saw the hunger in South Africa. And now she's in charge of this food program, this international food program that she found the passion to do as a result of that work and constantly working with the South African kids when she came back. And now she's running this program, a national program, an international program on food insecurity. And it was so interesting to, because she said it was that one experience that gave her something to do, that she realized that that was her passion. So rather than sit and wait, student, this is your moment. Don't believe you're the future. You are the now. Get it done. You know, find something on your campus. There's a lot of stuff in Riverside, and there's a lot of things in Riverside community that needs help, that needs students who know how to read and write and who can write things. Like I said, I wrote all the obituaries in my community. Why? Because I knew how to write. And my mother said that other folks didn't know how to write. And so every time somebody died, I had to go into my neighborhood. I had to go to the neighbor's house and write the obituary of her son or this one or that one. I learned a lot about those folks. I learned a lot about my community. I learned a lot about their needs. And so never turn down these opportunities, because you'd be surprised how they open doors for you to do things that you never dreamt of before. I tell people some of the things I did. As a teenager, I did an album, a gospel album, and took my friends across country to promote this album. I mean, you know, I was 20 years old, 21 years old. I mean, who does that stuff? You know, I mean, but we wanted to do it. We formed an octet. We were really good and well-known. And then we decided we wanted to go across country to do this program. And so we had been singing these songs. We raised the money. We went to the studio, created the album, got the cover, did the whole bit back in the day, and had a great time doing it. It's a part of our life when we were in our 20s that, you know, if we had been like others and said, well, we don't have a promoter and we don't have a director and we don't have a, we wouldn't have done anything. Okay. So do what you want to do. It's your opportunity to try things, make mistakes, do good work, find meaning in your life. Stop waiting for tomorrow. It is now. It is now that you make that difference. You don't have to be an elected official. You'd have much more fun not being one.
I think that is an amazing note to end on, that you don't have to wait for tomorrow, to do it now. And I think that message that you mentioned about not waiting for the big moment, not waiting for the big thing, but that the little things do matter, is so powerful, coming from your experience and your position, Dr. Weber. That it was amazing to hear you speak on not only your career in public service and the amazing work you've done, but the message that you not only that you give, but that you also embody yourself. It was an honor to speak with you.
Thank you very much for the invitations. Thanks to both of you. Thanks so very much, Kevin. I enjoyed it. And the gentleman who's on here with me, he's been with me since the beginning. He's one of those folks who's been loyal and faithful and diligent and hardworking and makes my office what it is. I thank him so much, Joe, for being online with us today. Thank you.
This podcast is a production of the UC Riverside School of Public Policy. Our theme music was produced by C. Codane. I'm Kevin Karami. Till next time.